Testing. I think everyone can hear me. Shavua Tov. Usually people say I actually speak loud without a microphone, so it should be like double amplified. First of all,
louder?
Well, you really just want to hear Rav left. You don't want to hear me, so I'm sure the Rav will speak louder. Is it loud enough for you, but without the echo? Okay. So first of all, I'd like to thank Beis Tefila and Rav Milinowitz for letting us use the Olam here, the shul, for Rav Lev's shiur tonight. The shiur is sponsored Zecher Nishmas, a very chashuv lady who Rav Lev will speak about before he starts the shiur, or in the middle of the shiur. The shiur is also co-sponsored by ACE, a new high school that's been around for 2 years, which deals with boys from age 14 to 19 who have not found themselves in the regular system. There is not a house in Klal Yisrael that has not been touched by the phenomena of students, boys, girls, who aren't fitting into the system, whether it's their own children, whether it's their neighbor's children. There's not a building in all of Jewish communities around the world that have one house, if not more, that have children who are falling through the cracks. I just came back myself from Kutz Laretz on Thursday, and I dealt with people from Lakewood, from Muncie, from Brooklyn, everywhere. So when we look outside, and unfortunately we have it here in Ramat Beit Shemesh also, we have to realize it's all over the world. It doesn't matter what color yarmulke you have, it doesn't matter denim skirt versus regular skirt of the mother, it's in every house, or in every area. There are kids who don't fit the system. What happens to those kids? Up until 2 years ago, in general, the philosophy was, well, if a kid falls through the cracks, you kind of hope he doesn't kill himself. You wait till he's about 18, 19. You send him to a yeshiva that does recovery. Either it could be for drugs, other issues, and then hope he can flip in and then come back to, you know, serving a Kodesh Baruch Hu and come back to the Jewish people. What we've realized is, why wait till they're 18, 19? Let's get to them before they get into that process. So ACE was founded on the concept of the wilderness camp. In America, there's remote expeditions run by Ariel Fishman, one of our program director, who we saw that kids, when they go to these camps, they do phenomenal in 2 months in America in the summer. But then what happens? They come right back to the schools and they don't do well again. So we realize, what's the solution? Take that element of the camp, the wilderness camp that builds the self-esteem, which is the common denominator in all these kids, and help build their self-esteem through physical challenges throughout the year. So basically, they learn in the morning Kodesh, in the afternoon they're doing craftsmanship, they built beds, they built their shenders, they built their bookcases, they built benches, as well as 1 day a week is a full-blown wilderness tour, which could mean 8 hours biking, could mean 10 hours hiking in the rain, just like in the army. But when the kids literally climb a mountain, they feel inside incredible, and then that transfers itself to the Limudei Kodesh and the relationship with the Kodesh Baruch Hu. To give you an example, the boys this Shabbos are up in the Golan in a mechina called Keshet Yehuda. We wanted them to see, because many of them are of the age, what they're going to decide to do. Some will go to the army, some will go to a mechina, and some maybe even Hezer. And some will go to Nachal Haridi. And the boys had a phenomenal Shabbos, and it's still continuing. And one boy in particular, who comes to us from Brooklyn, he's not from the Ramah, but he comes to us from Brooklyn, and he went through very hard times, and he was a boy who went through probably 5, 6 high schools in his 2 years of high school, and he came to us, said, this is a place, this Mechina, this is a place I can identify, and I can see myself in a year coming to. That's an incredible leap for a boy who 6 months ago was wandering the streets of Brooklyn. And now he's talking about going to a mechina and preparing himself spiritually before he goes into the army. So we have, Bli Ayin Hara, Baruch Hashem, an incredible staff that we've seen literally 100% results. Rav Lev knows many families who send to the school from different communities, as well as many of the Rabbanim in the community, etc., etc. So Bli Ayin Hara, Baruch Hashem, the results speak for themselves. And, you know, I look forward to the day that we don't have to have such a program, but unfortunately I see many more of these types of programming opening up before that day comes. And I think we just, before I turn over the floor to Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, who works very closely with us, and then Rabbi Lev's going to speak, that I just want to say that we have to recognize and realize that these boys, these students, when you see them outside in your communities, realize one of the reasons they end up going as far as they do is because they feel rejected by the community and by people. And as much as we know we open our hearts when Eishet Torah and Or Sameach and Ma'or and Makon Shlomo do Shabbatonim here in the Ramah and every community, and we welcome people who aren't from, who many people in the community have started off like that themselves 20, 30 years ago, with these children, a lot of times they can feel the community looking at them and really having, you know, not good feelings towards them. And if we just, I want the message for people to realize, if we open our hearts and keep these kids in the loop, we have a much greater chance of these kids not going where they end up. I'm going to call upon just Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik to say a couple of words, as it is being a Rebbe in the school. If anyone has any questions about the school, please feel free to ask us after the program, or you can call us. There's numbers on the flyers. Rabbi Soloveitchik.
Rishus Rav Lev, Rishus my colleagues, Yeshivas Ace, Rishus Kol Kahal Nechvad. I was thinking over Shabbos what to speak about. Obviously, Rav Lev is going to give a Shir Torah. I was trying to understand how I can express my experience that I had over the past year. I remember with Hoshana Rabbah, I got a call from Avi Klein. He wanted to speak to me about this new idea he had to start the school. At that time in my life, I was actually looking for something different, and I agreed. As Rosh Chodesh Kislev came around, the start date for ACE, I began to get a little nervous, because I had been used to teaching Gemara, Rishonim, Reb Chaim's on the Rambam, and somehow I knew this wasn't going to go in this yeshiva. I wasn't sure. How could I somehow or another help these boys understand and appreciate the beauty of the Torah? And right before we started, I had the pleasure of meeting another esteemed colleague, as almost all the boys know in the neighborhood, Kevin Unger, and he said to me, there are three things these boys want to learn about. Number one is about Purim, specifically the sugya of Chayiv Inish Lugzume B'Puraya. That's number one. Number two, the ninth parak of Brachos, which deals with the sugya of dreams. And number three, the sugya of Shade and about demons. It was Rosh Chodesh Kislev. There was no way I was going to stretch teaching Maseches Megillah, the sugya of Purim. And my own experience with teaching about dreams, it lasts 1 or 2 days, and somehow the excitement wears off. So I began with the sugya about Shaden, something I have to tell you, I really never learned B'Iyun before. And we spent a few days, and then I was stuck. So I started to speak about, they wanted to hear about Mashiach and Olam Haba. And the truth be told, I'm actually a follower of the Rambam. The Rambam and the Hilchos Malachim basically feels you should focus on mitzvot that are nogeya bizmaneinu. So I had a very difficult time with that. And then we began to discuss every day. We started off, let's begin with a question. And the boys at that point would begin to ask questions about halacha, about hashkafa. And I have to tell you that some of the questions that they asked were questions that they had asked for a number of years and either weren't given answers or were given but in a very blunt way, as a matter of fact, without explaining. And some of the answers they didn't like, but they definitely appreciated the honesty and the openness. And a year later, or more than a year later, I have to tell you, Baruch Hashem, we're not learning about Shadim. I guess Purim's coming up, so I think this week I will be doing the Sugya of Purim. What can I do? And I haven't touched the Sugya of Dreams. Oh, no, actually, it's not one day on it. But we're learning about life, about halacha, and the boys every day are interested and focused, and they want to grow, and they want to learn more, and they want to keep asking. I'm not saying that there aren't challenges. I'm not saying that there are valleys. But there are very few days now that I come home in frustration and asking myself, what did I accomplish? I really feel like these boys need to be taught, need to connect. And I'll just finish off with 2 points. I think the biggest nachas that I have, that on Friday night, when these boys don't have to be in school, there are a few boys that actually come to my shul, they stand in the back, and they daven Kabbalah Shabbos. It has nothing to do with my shul, it has to do with the fact that they connect to me. And that makes it very important, and they feel a connection enough to come to daven B'tzibur every Friday night. And the second point I'll finish off with is a story. Before I made Aliyah, I lived in a community called Hamilton, Ontario. Hamilton, Ontario was a community of 30 families, 30 Frim families, and maybe 200, 300 families that are affiliated but not yet religious. The Rav of the community is the Rav, Rabbi Green, who in the late 60s had a dream to make Aliyah. At that time, when he was planning to make Aliyah from Hamilton, someone who was very involved and the government here in Israel, I forgot who it was, told him he should go speak to Lubavitcher Rebbe Zecharon Livracha. And he went to Lubavitcher Rebbe. Lubavitcher Rebbe told him, your place is in Hamilton. And he said, but Rebbe, he said, what will be with my children? He told me, the Rebbe said to him, if you watch over HaKadosh Baruch Hu's children, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will watch over you. And every day when I go to teach at Ace, this is the message that comes through to me. Because we are concerned about our children. Everyone should be concerned. And I think if I watch over HaKadosh Baruch Hu's children, I connect to them, I talk to them, I learn with them, then Mirat Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will watch over my children. And it's the same thing I want to tell to you about all the children that are in the neighborhood that maybe aren't having an easy time. Whether they're an ace or not an ace, whatever they're doing, if you care about them, if you talk to them, if you pay attention to them, and the institutions that try to help them, and you're watching over HaKadosh Baruch Hu's children, I'm sure HaKadosh Baruch Hu will watch over your children. Now, just I think Rav Lef is a person who needs no introduction, and really it's very becoming for me to have the village introduce Rav Lef, and I'm sure that we are ready for an evening to come out and understand. And really, after Rav Lef's shir, we'll have a new appreciation of Purim. It will make our Purim much more meaningful. Without further ado, Rav Lef. I ask everyone to please switch off their cell phones.
I'll tell you the truth. Shus Chaim Soloveitchik, Shlita Klein. Sitting and listening to Rabbi Soloveitchik, and Rabbi Klein, I think I feel my age a little bit. I really can't imagine anything exhilarating about biking 8 hours in the rain or climbing a mountain. Yes. I think I can more relate to the dreams. I'm not even dreaming of it. My son, Yossi, runs 45 kilometers, he tells me, or what. I can't imagine that either. I have trouble walking to my car. In any case, I am honored both to be here, sponsored by people who wish to be anonymous, but in memory of Chedva Fradl, Bas Alta Yehuda, Alea Shalom, who was a Talmida of mine in Netanya. She used to come to my shiurim. In fact, I asked that a picture of her be brought so I could remember who she was. And Taka, I remember very well. She used to sit in the front and ask questions, and really good questions. And she didn't let up. If she didn't get an answer that she liked, she asked the question again. And those kind of talmidos are machim the Rebbe. So I am honored to be able to give this year le'ilu yishmasa. It happens to be that tonight Zion Adar, aside from being Moshe Rabbeinu's yahrzeit, is also my brother's yahrzeit, Chaim Simcha Mordechai ben Avi Mori Pesach. So I want to make mention of him also, and have a very close Talmid friend who is in need of a big refuah shleima. There tonight is a gathering to say tilim for him at the Kosel. He's going to go through a very serious operation in America. Tzvi Moshe ben Miriam Rochel, so he should have a refuah shleima also, and the Divrei Torah should also be a schus for his refuah shleima. In addition, the anonymous sponsors decided that they want the evening not anonymously sponsored by the ACE High School. You've heard from Rabbi Klein, Rabbi Soloveitchik, a little bit about the school. I am familiar with some of the Talmidim, and not everybody fits the same mold in this world. I don't know if I fit the mold, but in any case, I don't know what mold exactly it is. Mold is usually something that represents something that is decaying. So it's important that different people are given different opportunities, and not everything hits everybody's neshama the same way. And if boys need 8 hours in the rain, cycling and climbing mountains, and that is going to get to their neshama, then matovu manoi. And I see the success, and they should be successful with many, many more. The essence of Purim, I'll tell you the truth, when I first thought about what I'm going to speak about tonight, I was going to tell you about Purim and Amalek, and then I decided, as so many other people tell you the same things, a little bit different Divrei Torah, a little bit different perspective, I'd rather speak about what the real essence of Purim is all about, which is Simcha. We said it tonight. What is the consummate effect of what we gained at Purim? La'yehudim, hoysa'ora, the Simcha, the Sason, the Kor. That's Purim. That's the essence of Purim. And Chazal say, Ora zu Torah. What is this Ora? That's Torah. Simcha is Yontif. Sason is Mila. And Yikar is Tefillin. If I could explain to you why these things, Torah, Yontif, Mila, and Tefillin, are the essence of Purim. In order to do that, I have to understand what Simcha really is, because that is basically the essence of Purim, Simcha. Afilu mishanichnas adar marvin de simcha, and it culminates at its height at Purim itself. Simchas Purim. What's simcha? So let me tell you what people think simcha is, and it's not. Most people think that simcha is something that you don't have, that if you would have it, you'd be happy. Some object, some experience, money, whatever it may be, a job, a house, for some people getting married, for some people having children. It's what you're missing right now, but if you only had it, you'd be happy. That is not happiness. That is what it says in the Declaration of Independence of the United States of America, the pursuit of happiness. Every American is guaranteed the pursuit of happiness. It doesn't say you're guaranteed to be happy. Even in America, you're not guaranteed happiness. You're just guaranteed to pursue it. Let me tell you what the pursuit of happiness is like. When I was a rabbi in Miami many years ago, I was familiar, not personally, but I promise you, but only indirectly, with the following phenomenon. In many parts of the world, there are horse races. In Miami, they had dog races, greyhound dogs that raced. There is a fundamental difference between dog races and horse races, aside from the fact that one is horses and one is dogs. There's another difference. Horses have people with some intelligence that ride on them and know that if they win the race, they get more money than if they lose. So they have an incentive to make the horses run fast, which they do in many ways. Dogs have nobody riding on them. So they don't have any idea that if they win the race, they get better accommodations than if they lose. So what makes them run? What gives them the incentive to run? You can't get the dogs together before the race and say, listen guys, a lot of money running on this race, you know, please do your best. So what they have is the following. They have a mechanical rabbit that looks like a rabbit, smells like a rabbit. It's called Speedy. And it's on a radio controlled track. And it runs ahead of the dogs. So when, right before the dogs start running, the rabbit starts running. And the faster the dogs go, the faster the rabbit goes. Because if the dogs ever caught that rabbit, they would realize that it may look like a rabbit and smell like a rabbit, but surely doesn't taste like a rabbit. And that would be the end of the races. So they're constantly pursuing that rabbit, but they never catch it. They get close and close, and the closer they get, the rabbit eludes them. That is the pursuit of happiness. People pursue things, and they think that if they'll just have them, they'll be happy. And when they get them, they find out there's something else. Somebody once told me a joke. A person felt that making it in this world was having one of these stretch limousines, like his boss has. And he worked very hard for years to save up enough money to buy himself a stretch limousine. And finally he made it. He had what would probably give him happiness in this world, a feeling of fulfillment. He owned a stretch limousine. But he wanted his boss to know that he made it. So he drives his stretch limousine over to his boss's house. He's not there. Drives around the block, and he finally finds his boss stopped at a red light in his stretch limousine. So he honks his horn, and the window comes down on the boss's stretch limousine. He looks over, he says, what do you want? He said, I want to show you that I have a stretch limousine just like you. I've made it. The boss says, yeah, tell me. Do you have a pool table in your stretch limousine? He said, no. Do you have a living room suite? No. Do you have a bar? No. He said, then what kind of stretch limousine is that? The guy is shattered. So he works hard for another few years and puts a bar and a pool table and a living room suite in his stretch limousine, and he goes to look for his boss again. Again, he's not home, drives around the block, and he finds him parked at a red light. And he honks and honks, and nothing happens. He runs out of the car, bangs on the window of the boss's limousine, and finally, after a few minutes, the window comes down. And the boss says to him, what do you want? He said, look, I have the bar and the living room suite and the pool table in my stretch limousine. And the boss says, for that you got me out of the shower? There is always something else. In fact, the more a person has, the less he has. I learned this lesson years ago. We wanted to build a new shul in Miami. So we decided that the board of directors decided that they wanted to ask each of the members of the shul for a $5,000 pledge over 5 years. This was about 30 years ago, 40 years ago, which was a considerable amount of money at the time. Considering I had people earning maybe $10,000 a year, which was an average salary, and then I had some doctors, lawyers that were earning $100,000, $150,000 a year, living in palatial homes. So I figured to go to the people who are earning $10,000 a year and ask them for a $5,000 pledge over 5 years, not going to be easy. So let me get some success first and go to the doctors and lawyers, and they'll give it to me out of their change purse, $5,000 over 5 years, and I'll be very successful with them, and then I'll go to the people who will be more difficult. So I remember sitting down with a doctor in a beautiful home who's earning six-figure income, and I tell him, look, all we want from you is a pledge of $5,000 over 5 years. And he starts to tell me this sob story, like it was cash flow. And I learned so many new words during that I never heard of before. My cash didn't flow. I kept it in my wallet, and that was it. By the time he was finished, I felt like giving him a quarter for a cup of coffee, because I really felt bad for this guy. And so it was with every single one of these people. Except all of them would tell me the following. Rabbi, I'm thinking of opening another office, expanding my practice, and if I can only double my income next year, you have your pledge. Okay. So I decided I'm not making any headway with these people, let me go to the poor people. And sure enough, I went to a person who's earning $10,000 a year. He tells me, Rabbi, how can I give you $5,000 over 5 years? I only own $10,000. But next year, I'm thinking of getting a second job and doubling my income. And if I can double my income, you have your pledge. Then I realized the rich people were $100,000 poor. And this guy was only $10,000 poor. He only needed another $10,000 to be able to give me the pledge. The other one needed $100,000 more. So the more you have, the more you think you catch the rabbit, the more Yesh Lo Mana Rotsa Masayim. You just want more. Things can't make you happy. Experiences can't make you happy. So then what is happiness? If that's not what it is, then what is it? So let me first tell you some very depressing medrashim. And I beg you not to leave before I explain them to you, because I didn't come here to depress you, especially a week before Purim. The Medrash says, you're familiar with it because Rashi brings it down in the beginning of Seder Vayeshet. Bikesh Yaakov leishe b'shalva. Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Lo dai l'tzadikim asher mesukim lahem l'olam haba. Yaakov wanted a little bit of peace and quiet, serenity in this world. Sit down, take it easy a little while. He had a very difficult life. Wanted a little simcha in his life, I guess. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, not enough for the tzaddikim what they have in Olam Haba. They want to take it easy in this world too. Nothing doing. Miyad kofetz alav rogzo sheYosef. Immediately Yaakov was pounced upon by the agitation of Yosef. What's so terrible if a tzaddik wants a little shalva in this world? Something wrong with that? The Torah Tmima asks in Tosfos Bracha, Lo hakol zochin l'shtei shulchanos. Not everybody gets two tables, this world and the next world. Not everybody doesn't. What's so terrible if Yaakov Avinu would have a little serenity? We daven for Mashiach, and we should have shalva. So what's so terrible about it? What's so wrong that Bikesh Yaakov leishe b'shalva? That the Rebbe Shem can't forgive him the shalva? Not enough what he has in Olam Haba? Now let me tell you even more depressing Medrash. Medrash says there was a woman who had probably the consummate nachas that any woman could ever have in this world. That was Elisheva Bas Aminadov on the eighth day, Shmini L'Meluim, when they consecrated the Mishkan. She saw her husband inducted to be the first Kohen Gadol in history. Her children were inducted as the first Kohanim Hedyotos in history. Her brother Nachshon Ben Aminadov was the first one to bring a korban for the korban Hanasiyim that first day, Rosh Chodesh Nisan. And her brother-in-law was Moshe Rabbeinu, Melech Yisrael. All the big players that day were her family. Can you imagine what nachas she had? And what happened that day? Two of her children died, were killed. Says the Medrash, you see from here, Ein simcha ma'akev la'af echad in this world. Simcha doesn't last too long for anybody in this world. Whenever there's a big simcha, there's always a monkey wrench, there's always something that somehow mitigates that simcha. Sometimes it's something not so serious, and sometimes it's serious. As a rabbi who has witnessed many, many simchas, the rule is true. There's always something. Always something. Isn't that depressing? Can't remain the simcha in this world? Why not? And I'll tell you what's even more depressing. The Medrash says why. The Medrash says, Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you know why simcha doesn't last for too many people in this world? For too long? Because HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, when I created the world, I was extremely happy. Yismach Hashem b'ma'asa. And I didn't remain happy too long, because Adam and Chava sinned, and they made me very unhappy. So if I couldn't remain happy too long in this world, nobody's going to remain happy in this world too long. The Rabban Shalom is spiteful, because he couldn't remain happy, nobody's going to remain happy. That sounds like the Rabban Shalom. What does it mean? So in order to understand it, I want to tell you a little bit about what this world is all about, which is pretty obvious, but as the Mesillas Yesharim says, it's the obvious things that we need to speak about often because we forget the obvious things. Let me start with the Medrash. The Medrash is in Koheles Rabbah on the Pasuk Me'uvas Lo Yuchal Liskon. There are certain things in this world that are uncorrectable. They are crooked and can never be corrected. And the Medrash gives the following story to illustrate that. There were once two Rishoyim that were partners in crime their entire life. They robbed, they murdered, very despicable people. And one of them died, he went to Gehenna, and he's suffering Gehenna for a considerable amount of time, until one day, the Medrash says, he looks up, and he sees that they're escorting the neshama of his partner into Gan Eden. So he calls over the Malach, who is appointed over the neshamas in Gehenna, and he says, there must have been a computer error, because that's my partner. When I stole, he stole. When I murdered, he murdered. If he belongs in Gan Eden, so do I. Get me out of here. And if I belong in Gehenna, so does he. Bring him here to keep me company. So either correct something over here and either bring me to him or bring him to me. The Malach comes back. He says, there's no mistake. He belongs in Gan Eden. You belong here. He says, I get it. He bribed somebody. Just tell me how much and who. I'll double the amount. The Malach says, I'm sorry, but there is no bribery here. He says, then explain to me, why is he in Gan Eden? I'm in Gehenna. He said, you don't know what happened after you died. You see, you were walking in the street one day and you dropped dead in the middle of Rishus HaRabbah. And nobody wanted to bury you. They just left your body rot in the street for 3 days because you were such a despicable person. And then after 3 days, some benevolent, merciful person kicked your body into a hole in the side of the road and that's where you're buried. When your partner saw this, it really hit him hard. And he said to himself, is this the way I want to end up? Dead in the street? Nobody wants to bury me? And he started rethinking his entire life. And he eventually repented. And he lived his last years as a totally repentant tzaddik. So he's in Gan Eden and you're in Gehenna. Now, I can't see the women up there, but they tell me there are women there. I must now add in parentheses the following. I don't have to say this for the men, because I don't think there's one man here who's thinking of this question, but I'm sure that it's plenty of women upstairs. And that is the following. This isn't fair. The first guy didn't have anybody to learn from, and the second guy had somebody to learn from. So it's not fair. Is there any men thinking of that question? I don't think so. Women? Yeah. I'm guaranteed. Let me just explain to you, for the women's sake, that you don't think about this the rest of the time, you don't listen to anything I'm saying. It's fair. Let me tell you that the first person also had someone he could have learned from. The Medrash doesn't mention it, because the Medrash is not interested in telling us the life story of these two people. He just wants to bring across a message. But I guarantee you, so don't feel bad for the first guy, that he had somebody he could have learned from, and he didn't. The second guy did. And that is the end of that he'or. Okay. Now the women can start listening again. So the Malach tells him, so the guy says, oh, he did tshuva. I thought this was going to cost me money. That's great. I'm also ready to do tshuva. Believe me, if I would have known where I'm going to end up, I never would have done it. I regret it. I'll never do it again. Chatosi, avisi, poshati. Get me out of here. The Malach says, I'm sorry, but it's a little late. Don't you know that the world you came from is like Erev Shabbos? And the world you're in now is like Shabbos. Somebody who prepares himself on Erev Shabbos has what to eat on Shabbos. You didn't prepare yourself in the world you came from. Now you wake up, Leil Shabbos, and you want to do tshuva? Yeah, you can't do tshuva. It's like making a meal on Shabbos. You can't make the meal on Shabbos. Make it before Shabbos. You didn't do anything before Shabbos. Too late. And don't you know, the Malach said, the world you came from is like the dry land. And the world you're in now is like the sea. If you prepare your boat with supplies on the dry land, you have what to eat in the middle of the ocean. You set sail with an empty boat. Now you want to all of a sudden get supplies? Too late over here. There's no supermarkets in the middle of the ocean. You should have prepared it before you left. And don't you know, the Malach said, the world you came from is like the city. And the world you're in now is like the desert. If you prepare a survival kit in the city, you can survive in the desert. But you can't get the survival kit in the desert. You're in the desert now. Too late now. Now you can't do tshuva. Tshuva you should have done before you left. And the man realizes that there's no hope. And this is Be'uvas lo yuchal lisko. Something crooked that can never be corrected. That's the Medrash. Two things bothered me about this Medrash. Firstly, there's an analogy in the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos that compares this world to the next world. Ha'olam hazeh domeh leprozdor bifnei ha'olam haba. This world is like a preparation room to a castle. Hatzkein atzmecha beprozdor kedei shetikonesh letraklin. Prepare yourself in the preparation room in order that you should be able to get into the castle. Why didn't the Malach tell him a mission, Pirkei Avos? Told him three Mishalim, Erev Shabbos and Shabbos, Yam and Yabasha, and Ir Moshav and Midbar. Why didn't you tell him a mission, Pirkei Avos? Didn't you know the world you came from is like the preparation room and this world is like the castle? You didn't prepare yourself in the preparation room, you can't get in the castle. Why are you telling three Mishalim and not the one that's in Pirkei Avos? And secondly, I'm sure the guy got the message after the first marshal. Why was it necessary to tell him three Mishalim? So my Mechutin, he wasn't my Mechutin then, said to me once when he heard this Kasha, he said, Rabbi, that's Gehenna, listening to extra long drashas that aren't necessary. He's still my Mechutin, but I don't accept that as an answer, not as a rabbi. So, Taka, why was it necessary to tell him three Mishalim? In order to understand this, I want to mention something that is simple, obvious. What are we doing here? What's this world all about? Why are we here? So Chazal tell us the following. And this does not answer the question, why did God create the world the way he did? There is no answer to that question. I'll explain to you in a little while what that means. The question we're answering is, once God created the world the way he did, what can we understand about it? So what can we understand? What are we doing here? What's this world all about? Chazal tell us that HaKadosh Baruch Hu, being the ultimate good, wanted to shower his goodness on a creation that could receive that good. And the ultimate good is HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So he wanted to shower himself on a creation that could have an eternal bond with him. Dveikus Vashem. And that is the greatest eternal pleasure that a person can have. That relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That's the purpose of the Bria. HaKadosh Baruch Hu wanted to shower a creation that could receive that eternal pleasure of having a bond with him. So, HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have created our neshamas and put us into Olam Haba with a constant bond with him. That's what Olam Haba is. Sadikim Yoshvin Va'atroseim Brosheim V'nehenem Miziv Ashchina. And that would have been it. But the Rabbi Shalom knew that if he showered that goodness on us, unearned and undeserved, it wouldn't be the ultimate pleasure. Because what a person gets, unearned and undeserved, is not the full amount of pleasure. So HaKadosh Baruch Hu put us in this world, distant from him, put our neshamas into a body in a physical world. He created this physical world. And he told us, you create the relationship with me. You create the bond with me. instead of me creating it with you. And we're put here for 120 years and we have the opportunity to create a bond with the Rabban Shalom and to earn, more than earn, to create our Olam Haba. That's the purpose of this world. And let me just explain to you, because you've heard this before, and there's a tremendous question on this, which the Ramchal does not answer. It gives a hint of an answer, but whatever you'll answer is no answer. And that is the following. HaKadosh Baruch Hu could have saved a lot of time and money. He didn't have to create this world. All he had to do is change one little rule that Lechora he could do. Instead of creating neshamas that don't appreciate what they don't earn, just create neshamas that appreciate what they don't earn. You didn't have to create this world. Why not could HaKadosh create neshamas that don't appreciate what they don't earn and have to create this world to make up for that? Just create neshamas that can appreciate what they don't earn. The answer to that question is that there is no answer. No answer that we can understand. Because our minds are very limited. We are limited to what we have a point of reference to. What's within our realm. And I'll prove it to you. Close your eyes, not too tightly, because I don't want to be the only person awake over here. And picture in your mind's eye nothing. Nothing. There's some people who go through life like that all the time. But picture in your mind nothing. Okay, you have that nothing pictured in your mind. Now take your hand and put it into the nothing. Your hand now is inside that nothing. That's not nothing. That's space. Now try again. Nothing means no space. Don't even try. Get a headache. You can't imagine no space. You know why? Because you have no point of reference to it. Because we live in a world where there's always space. Your mind can't even fathom no space. One more example. Picture something in your mind that you never saw and never heard of. It's impossible. If you never saw and never heard of it, there's nothing you can picture. What can you picture? A monster with 10 heads, 4 arms, and 6 legs? But all of those things are just components that you did hear of. Something that has no component you ever heard or saw is impossible. You have no point of reference to it. Even HaKadosh Baruch Hu. We have no relationship to HaKadosh Baruch Hu outside the Bria. The name Yud-Kei Vav-Kei means that the Rabban Shalom is Mahava, this Bria. He's a creator. Outside of creation, we call him Ein Sof. That doesn't mean anything. It means I have no idea what I'm talking about. We can only refer to the Rabban Shalom within our point of reference. There's no name for the Rabban Shalom. And that's why the Mishnah says in Chagigah, you're not allowed to ask what's before the world, what's beyond the world. Not because it's awesome. It's impossible. It's out of our realm. It's out of our point of reference. And therefore asking questions, why couldn't God have created the world differently, is a question before the Bria. It's on God's mind. There's no answer to that question. Our minds can't possibly fathom it. What can we understand? Once the Rabban Shalom created the world the way he did, what can we understand about it? That's it. The Rabban Shalom created a world where that's a fact. That people appreciate what they earn more than they appreciate what they don't earn. So we are put in this world to earn Olam Haba, but that's not really the case. Earning Olam Haba, people think, is like a Purim carnival. There's games to play, and if you win, you get coupons. At the end of the day, right, they add up your coupons, they send over to the prize booth. If you have a lot of coupons, you get a big bear, and a little bit of coupons, you get a small bear. That's what happens in this world. You know, there's games to play, they're called mitzvahs. If you do them right, you get points. Unfortunately, there's other games you can play that have demerits, and you get points taken off. And after 120 years, they punch your name into this master computer, add up all your points, give you a coupon, go to the prize booth and cash it in for a share in the world to come. It doesn't work like that. Because that wouldn't be the ultimate pleasure. Let me give you an example. Imagine if you wanted one of these plush reclining chairs. And your birthday was coming up and you were hoping that your aunt was going to give you this chair for the birthday. And she did. Gave you the chair and you sat in it and you really enjoyed it. But what happens if your aunt didn't come across with the chair and your birthday went and you got another tie or something like that? And you really want this chair. So you're willing now to go to work for a month, 6 days a week, 8 hours a day to earn enough money to finally buy the chair. And you do that. And you go and you buy the chair. And now you sit in it. You think you'd appreciate it more, of course. But what would be the following scenario? You planted trees, You nurture them for years until they grew enough to cut them down for lumber. You cut down the trees, made lumber, and made the frame of the chair. Then you mined iron, made it into nails, knocked it together. Now you have the chair frame put together. Then you raised sheep, sheared their wool, stuffed the chair with it. Then you raised cotton, spun it into thread, made it into the upholstery of the chair. And now you sat in the chair. Do you think you'd appreciate even more? What do you see? That what you earn, you appreciate more than you get for free, and what you create, you appreciate more than what you earn. So in order that Olam Haba should be the ultimate appreciation, the ultimate pleasure, you can't earn it. You have to make it. You have to create it. It's our creation. And that's what the Rabbanim Shlom did. He put us in this physical world, and he gave us opportunities to create Olam Haba. How so? We can do things in this world that make our neshama more like God or less like God. Behold, drachecha do'ehu. Torah and mitzvahs are only a guide. They're not the only thing. Torah and mitzvahs guide us what kinds of things make us godly and what kinds of things are ungodly. And everything a person does, every second of his life, any area of life, your married life, your social life, your political life, your economic life, everything can be done in a way that makes you more like God or less like God. And the more like God you are, the greater of a kesher you have with the Rabban Mishalom after 120 years. And the less like the Rabban Mishalom, the less of a kesher you have. We create that bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu every second in this world. And it's every second. And everything. On any level. The Gemara says there was a famous Abarion, infamous Abarion, Eliezer ben Durdoi, that in the midst of a chet, something happened that shocked him to do tshuva. And he did such an intense tshuva that immediately afterwards he died. And a bas call resounded, Ashrecha Rabbi Eliezer ben Durdoi, shemesukin l'olam haba, that he earned his olam haba in that 1 second of intense tshuva. And when Rabbi Yehuda Anossi, Rabbeinu HaKadosh, heard this story, he cried. And he said, Yishkona Olama B'Shoachas, it's possible for a person to earn his Olam Haba in 1 second. So the Tosa Rosh Hashiva asked, what was he crying about? He should have been excited, elated. Wow, you can get Olam Haba in 1 second. What's the cry about? He says, at that moment, Rabbeinu HaKadosh realized he could do it every second. There's no limit to Olam Haba in mathematics. There's an infinite amount of whole numbers, but there's also an infinite amount of fractions between each whole number. So there's an infinite amount of infinities in mathematics. If it applies to mathematics, it can apply to Olam Haba too. There's an infinite amount of eternities. There's no limit. You can get more and more and more and more every second. And Rabbi Yehuda Anossi realized that how many seconds do we let slip through our fingers and we don't do anything? We don't accomplish anything. That's what's to cry about. But from a Torah standpoint, every second in this world, no matter what level of life you're on, from a secular standpoint, this world is important because you can get pleasure in this world. You can enjoy yourself. That's what this world is all about. Enjoy yourself. So how much pleasure can you get in 1 second? Not too much. So you need a lot of seconds to make life worthwhile, to make it, give it value. There's no intrinsic value to life. Its value is how much pleasure you can have. So 1 second is not going to give you pleasure. You need 10 seconds, 20 seconds, an hour. You have a lot of years, more quantity of life, so the more life is worth something. But that's not the only factor. Because you can be 20 years old and be in a coma in the hospital, and your quality of life is close to zero. So you may have a lot of quantity, but no quality. What kind of pleasure can you get in a coma? Eat a steak, watch a movie, what can you do in a coma? Nothing. But from a Torah standpoint, every second of life, on the lowest level of quality, in a coma in the hospital, and you're 119 and three quarters, you don't have too much quantity or too much quality, Chayisha is worth eternity. Why? Because in 1 second you can do tshuva. In 1 second you can think about doing the mitzvahs that you do with thought. Avas Hashem and Yiras Hashem. In 1 second, you can think about doing mitzvahs that you can't physically do, and Machshava Tova, Kadosh Baruch Hu Mitzvah for Lamaisa. You do everything. And even if the EEG says flat brain waves, that doesn't mean the person's not thinking. As long as he's still alive, his heart is beating, I don't want to get into this subject, but in any case, but his heart is beating, he's still alive, he can think. And even if the machine doesn't pick it up, maybe the machines aren't sensitive enough to pick up that kind of thought. Maybe in 20 years they'll create a machine that's more sensitive, and then we'll apologize for pulling the plug. We didn't know you were thinking. Or it could be the machine won't pick up anything. The person's neshama is thinking, but his neshama is still connected to his body. So it makes a big difference to his olam haba. And he can think about any one of these things in 1 second and create eternity. Every second in this world is eternally valuable. That's what this world is all about. And that's why the real mashal to olam hazeh and olam haba is what it says in Pirkei Avos. This world is a preparation room to a castle. Let's analyze the mashal. Why do they build a preparation room to a castle? For one purpose and one purpose alone. To prepare to go in the castle. There's no other purpose for building. What do they equip it with? Only things that will help you get into the castle. Prepare to get into the castle. They don't put pool tables in there or ping pong tables. Only brushes and hair dryers and whatever that you need to be able to prepare to get in the castle. It's all it's equipped with. And what are you supposed to do in there? Nothing except prepare to go in the castle. It's not made for any other purpose. It's not equipped for any other purpose. And it's not used for any other purpose. That's olam hazeh. There is absolutely no purpose to this world except to use as a preparation for olam haba. That doesn't mean sitting in a corner and saying tilim all your life and preparing for the world to come. It means living every single second in this world with an understanding that I can create eternity with everything I do, how I eat, how I drink, how I conduct my business, how I conduct my pleasure, how I go hiking and climbing mountains and pedaling in the rain. That also can be done in a way that's godly, with the right intention or the wrong intention. And every second, on every level, in everything that you're doing, can be done in a way that is creates a bond with HaKadosh Baruch Hu that's more godlike or less godlike. That's what this world is all about. That's the marshal of Pirkei Avos. But go tell a Rasha who lived his whole life in crime, didn't you know that this world, the whole purpose of it was to prepare for... Of course he didn't know that. He doesn't know it now either. A person dies, doesn't become a big tzaddik and a philosopher, he becomes dead. That's it. Rishoyim afilu l'pislos al gehenem, einam chosrim. So go waste your breath, the malach, and tell him a mission Pirkei Avos. He didn't tell him that. But he said, in your mind, maybe you understood a little bit differently. Maybe in your mind, this world was like Erev Shabbos, and the world to come was like Shabbos. Different marshal. Erev Shabbos, you eat breakfast for Erev Shabbos, you work a little bit for Erev Shabbos. Erev Shabbos has an intrinsic value to itself, but the majority of Erev Shabbos is to prepare for Shabbos. Maybe that's what you understood. This world's a nice place, but the majority is to prepare, so why don't you prepare? And even if that you didn't understand. But in your mind, this world and the next world were equal. Dry land and ocean, equally important. But you knew that one day your boat was going to set sail. Why didn't you prepare? And even if that you didn't believe, and in your mind this world was the ikr, this is the city, and olam haba in your mind was a desert, desolate, meaningless to you. But you knew one day everybody goes into that desert. Why didn't you prepare a survival kit? Either you didn't believe altogether, so you surely don't deserve to have olam haba, or you believe but you never bother to prepare. Either way, that's why you're in Gehenna and your friend is in Gan Eden. That's what the Malach told him. No matter what you thought, but the real hashkafa is there is no second in this world that a person is not supposed to do. Whatever it is in this world, the world's only equipped for that. Everything HaKadosh Baruch Hu created, from the worms in the Amazon, somehow they affect what a person can do in this world that human beings need to be an opportunity to be able to create olam haba. That's it. It wasn't created for any other purpose. It's not equipped with anything else. And that's not what you're supposed to do. All you're supposed to do is prepare for olam haba. But everything that you do in this world, and everything that comes your way, is an opportunity to do that. So now let me tell you a story. And then we'll understand the two depressing medrashim that we started with. When I was about 10 years old in Miami, the supermarket in our neighborhood had a contest. And the first prize of the contest was 15 minutes in the supermarket to take off the shelves for free, whatever you could take. A woman won this contest. And they invited the entire neighborhood to come and watch her claim her prize. So, 10 years old, I went with my two brothers, Aleihem HaShalom, and we went to watch this woman claim her prize. It really sounded interesting. So I remember she was showing off the sneakers that she bought so she could run fast through the aisles and grab as much as she could. She had two carts, one on each arm, so she didn't run out of space to put the things in. And she had probably what was the forerunner of a GPS. This was 50 years ago. She had this contraption that went around her head, had a piece sticking out and a map of the supermarket attached to it so she could see it in front of her, marked off the most expensive parts of the supermarket so she'd go to there first. So I told her, lady, we're going to say ready, get set, blow a whistle, and you go. And the next 15 minutes, whatever you take is yours. But as soon as we blow the whistle at the end of the 15 minutes exactly, it's over. And if you grab anything after that, it's ours. So if you understand the rules, ready, get set, go. They blow the whistle and she starts running like a meshuggah. After 5 minutes, she was perspiring profusely, breathing heavily. Imagine if somebody came to her and said, lady, you look really tired. Why don't you have a seat? Here's a chair. Sit down, rest for a little while. Have a seat. And, you know, what's it called? Rest up. And you look really tired. You know what the lady would say? You do you mind? I have 15 minutes to grab what I can. Sit down every second to some other commodity. I'm going to sit down and rest now. After the 15 minutes is over and they blow the other whistle, bring me back the chair. I'll sit here for the rest of the week. But not now. Now's not the time to sit. B.K.S. Yaakov Leishay B'Shalva. The problem wasn't the Shalva. You can have Shalva in this world, and you can have peace and serenity. Nowhere in the Pasuk, Vayeshev Yaakov, is there hinted a word of Shalva. You know what the problem was? Vayeshev. B.K.S. Yaakov Leishay L'Hishake, to remain at rest, even for 1 second. That's all he wanted. You're at rest. You have a chance not to have problems, not to have tension. Fine. So now, be more dynamic. Grab some more. But to take it easy, it's like the woman sitting down in the middle of the 15 minutes. It's counterproductive. And therefore, Rashi says the following, with a different inflection. Same words, but everybody reads it wrong. It's not, it's not enough what they have in Olam Haba, they want this world too. That's not what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said. He said it a little bit differently. It's never enough what they have. There's always more eternity they can have. They want to take it easy in this world. They want to remain at rest, not be dynamic. It's like the lady sitting down in the middle of 15 minutes. I'm not going to let her do it. It's counterproductive. I'm going to give him something to agitate him. He shouldn't feel he's made it. He shouldn't feel that that's it. Don't be dynamic. This is world. Every second you can create eternity. There's no time to take it easy. Just for the sake of taking it easy. And that's exactly what it says. Lo ike simcha. If simcha leads you, lo yamale olam schopi b'olam hazeh, if it leads you to feel fulfilled, finished, I don't do anything more. I can sit on my laurels. That's it. That's counterproductive. The Rebbe Shem doesn't let that. You know why? Omer HaKadosh Baruch Hu. When I created the world, I could remain happy. I could have created a perfect world where people were robots and they couldn't do anything wrong and I would be happy all the time. But I didn't. I created a world, this world, that people should have free choice. And they should be able to sin. In order they should be able to be Zocha to Olam Haba. That's why I created this world. Had I created it for a different purpose, I could have remained happy. But that wasn't the purpose. The purpose was to be dynamic, and therefore I didn't remain happy because that's not the reason I created the world. And therefore nobody's going to remain happy. Because if people feel fulfilled in this world and they don't feel there's any reason to be dynamic, then it's counterproductive. That's not the reason the world was created. That's what HaKadosh Baruch Hu means. So now let's translate that into practical terms. The Chacham by the Seder asked the following question. Moha Eidos v'hachukim v'mishpatim asher tzivo Hashem Elokeinu Eser. What are all these mitzvahs? So if he doesn't know what the mitzvahs are, he can't be too much of a chacham. So the Ibn Ezra says, what it means is the following. Goyim only have to keep 7 relatively easy mitzvahs. And if they do it, and do it properly, the Rambam says, they're going to share in the world to come. And we have to keep 613 difficult mitzvahs. What did we do wrong that God laid this tremendous burden on us and nobody else? Why do we have to keep 613 mitzvahs? Nobody else has to do it. What did we do wrong? Why are we being punished for it? What's the answer we tell the Chacham? Avodim hayinu l'faro b'mitzrayim. Let's look at God's track record. He took us out of Mitzrayim for our sake or for His sake? Obviously for our sake. He took us through the Midbar for 40 years and took care of all of our needs. For our sake or for His sake? Obviously for our sake. He gave us Eretz Yisrael for our sake or His sake? Obviously for our sake. So if He gave us all these mitzvahs, it must fit the pattern. That He gave it l'tov lanu, l'chayoseinu, kayom hazeh. It's not a burden. It's not a liability. It's an opportunity. The Rebbe Hashem gave us an opportunity by giving us so many mitzvahs. And that's what Rabbi Hananya ben Akasha said. God wanted to benefit us. That's one shot. We'll see another shot in a few seconds. He wanted to benefit us. And therefore He gave us an abundance of Torah and mitzvahs, because that's the way to create Olam Haba. And we have an abundance of possibilities. Every second. Every area of life. It's not a liability. It's not a burden. It's an opportunity. It's a schus. And that makes the following pasuk make sense. Because without this idea, the pasuk makes absolutely no sense at all. Pasuk says, after 40 years in the Midbar, Moshe Rabbeinu turns to Klal Yisrael and he says, V'ata Yisrael, bottom line, now, Mo Hashem Elokecha Shom, what does God want from you already? Ki im only, what should follow? Only a few measly things. You know what the end of that pasuk is? Kim Le'iris Hashem Elokecha Le'avos Oledovka Bovelechus Bechol Drachov Mishpatov Mitzvosov. Only a million things. What does God want from you already? Only a million things. Doesn't make any sense. Says the Ramban, the last two words of the pasuk make it make sense. L'tov loch. God doesn't want anything from you. It's all for your good. He wants to give you an opportunity. All of these things, l'yira, l'yava, l'dovka, it's all for your sake. He doesn't want anything from you. He wants to give you an opportunity. And that was the mistake the Goyim made. When the Torah was offered to the Goyim, they asked what's in it. God told the Esav, says, well, Sirtzav, they said, we have a problem. We live by the sword. Al-Kharba Chatichia, it's a bracha from Yitzchak Avinu. How could we have a Torah? It says, well, Sirtzav. So God left them. It always bothered me. Why did He leave them? Why didn't He explain to them that there's no problem? Al-Kharba Chatichia does not mean murder. It means you'll be mercenaries, soldiers of fortune. People will hire you to fight their battles. That's wartime. That's not murder. Now, no problem. Al-Kharba Chatichia is compatible with Lo Sirtzach. You want the Torah. Why did He leave them abruptly? There are many answers to that question. But I think an answer can be the following. If I would have come here this evening and said, you know, I really hate to do this, but I need a favor from you. Can you do me a favor? Even if you were very good-hearted people, you could not say yes just like this. You'd have to ask me first, what do I want? Because maybe it's something you can't do. Maybe I want you to carry my car home for me. Maybe I want you to give me $1 million interest-free loan for the next 100 years. Maybe you can't do that. You can see me after the shiur, but maybe you can't do that. So you couldn't say yes. You have to say, what do you want? And then when I say it, you would be able to respond yes or no. But if I would have come here tonight with a beautifully gift-wrapped package and say that I am so honored to have been able to speak here tonight, I want to show you my appreciation, here is a present. Would anybody here say, what is it? No. You take it graciously, and when I turn my back, you look fast to see what it was, right? That's how you take a present. You don't ask what it is, right? Difference, because what difference does it make? The present, take it. When HaKadosh Baruch Hu offered the Torah to the Goyim, they understood that God wanted something from them. He's asking them for a favor. He's giving them a liability. So they had to ask, what is it? We can't answer until we know if we can do it or not. And God said, maybe they're just curious. So He told them something difficult. They said, you know, it's a little of a conflict with us. We don't know if we can do you the favor. So God said, you think I want a favor from you? Think I'm asking you for a favor? Then you don't know what I'm talking about. There's nothing to talk about. Finish. We came to Klal Yisrael. They understood it's a present. Nasa v'nishma, give it. What do we care what it is? It's a present. Give us the present. They say a joke that when He came to the nations of the world, they said, what's in it? When He came to the Jewish people, they said, how much does it cost? Moshe said, it's free. They said, free, we'll take 10. not so far from the truth. We understood it's a present. And the Goyim thought that it's a liability. So Torah is a present. It's an opportunity. But is it? Rashi doesn't say that. Every time the Gemara brings a sugya of mitzvahs lav lehenes nitnu, Rashi says mitzvahs weren't given as a pleasure in this world. Elo, Rashi says, ke'ol al tzavoreinu. It's a yoke around our neck. Now that doesn't sound like an opportunity, a present, right? Something really nice to be happy with. It sounds like a yoke around your neck. That's what it sounds like. So who's right, me or Rashi? I'm telling you the Torah is a benefit, an opportunity, and Rashi says it's an all-out suffering. I'll tell you another story. The Torah says that the reason we go into Golis is tachas asher lo avadeto es Hashem Elokecha b'simcha v'tuv lev. We should serve God with happiness and a good heart because Torah nitzes is really happy. And yet the Torah says, you know why you go into Golis? And b'chukosai teleichu sheyu ameilim b'Torah. Torah demands a tremendous amount of omol and yigir, effort, toil. Now that doesn't sound like great simcha. So which is it? Torah is supposed to be b'simcha or b'omol and yigir. Which is it? The answer is very simple. Somebody gave you a treasure map that directed you to a buried treasure of millions and millions of dollars worth of precious gems. There's only one problem. The gems are buried 30 feet deep under solid rock in a mountain in the Andes. But you have the treasure map. You're the only one who has the treasure map. And you know for sure the treasure is there. But you have to put in a tremendous amount of expense and investment to get to the Andes. Right? A hefty plane trip. Finally you get to the place near this mountain and you find out that there's no way of getting there except by mule. So you hire a mule and you get to the mountain. Then you find out the mule's not interested in climbing the mountain. You have to climb it on your own. Right? This is something you should look into. And so you climb the mountain for weeks and weeks, finally get to the top of the mountain, and you realize there are no extension cords. So you can't use power tools. You've got to use a pick and an axe and a shovel and cut through solid rock for months, years. And finally you hit the treasure. The person who gave you the treasure map was giving you an opportunity or giving you a liability? Obviously an opportunity. Did it involve a tremendous amount of investment, of sacrifice, of hard work? Yes. Is it a simcha? Yeah. Simcha doesn't mean fun. Simcha means something that is kedai. And people today don't understand that. I saw in the Modia a few months ago that the orange growers in Israel have developed a new strain of orange, genetically engineered orange, which they invested millions of dollars in developing. New orange is going to have a thin, skin, and a peel, thin peel, and no pits. That is the new orange. So the reporter asked them what was wrong with the old orange, that they needed to invest millions of dollars in this new orange. So the answer was, people today want things fast and easy, and we have to please our clientele. So we had to create an orange that was fast to peel and easy to eat without pits. When it comes to oranges, that may be okay. But people want that when it comes to Torah and to life also. They want things fast and easy. And Torah is not fast and it's not easy. Definitely not. And that's why we live in a world where people have forgotten about mitzvahs and limud haTorah. You know what they want? Schoolers. Schoolers. Schoolers are fast and they're easy. Just do this, you know, jump up three times or whatever, say these words, and magically everything in life will be okay. Before Shavuos, on Erev Rosh Chodesh Sivan, there's a special tefillah to say from the Shaloh HaKadosh, that your children should be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah. People go crazy. Erev Shavuos, downloading this from Art Scroll or whatever, they can say, you know, this tefillah, because this is going to guarantee that their children will be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah. I tell my Kehillah, if you think that saying a tefillah once a year, no matter who composed it, is going to guarantee that your children will be B'nai Torah and B'nos Torah, you need your head examined. That's the icing on the cake. That's a schooler. It's very good. I don't mean to mitigate and diminish the importance of schoolers, but schoolers are like the icing on the cake. If you have the cake, the icing makes it really delectable. But if you don't have the cake, all you have is icing. It is extremely unhealthy and not very tasty either. You can't just have schoolers in this world. And this year I saw even worse. This year I saw that a tzedakah said, since it's hard to say the tefillah, so if you give $18 to the tzedakah, they'll say the tefillah for you. That will definitely guarantee that your children will be b'nei Torah, b'nei Torah. What could... That's the world we live in, schoolers. I heard on the radio, in the name of, I'll tell you who it was because you shouldn't guess, because I'm sure he never said such a thing. In the name of Chaim Kanievsky, and I guarantee, not 99%, 100%, that Chaim never said this. Never. He couldn't have said it because it's idiotic. And Chaim is a tzaddik and a Talmud Chacham. This stalker dealt or deals with handicapped children. Supposedly, Reb Chaim said that if you give money to this tzedakah, he guarantees that you will never have a handicapped child. You hear this? God doesn't guarantee it. But Reb Chaim said he did. Reb Chaim never said it. Never. Whatever he said and they misunderstood, they said. I give them the credit that they didn't just stop making it up. They misunderstood what he said. It's absurd. That's life. All you have to do is give $18 to this tzedakah and it's a guarantee. That's pretty good. Now, imagine if you get $36. So that's the world we live in. Fast and easy. Mitzvahs, Torah. And everything has to be fun. Torah has to be fun. Because not fun, who wants to do it? So we train our children. Torah is fun. I sit sometimes with my grandson, lives on the Moshav, and he's infatuated with Uncle Moshe. So I sit with him, I'm also infatuated with Uncle Moshe. Uncle Moshe says, you know, you be a mitzvah boy and a mitzvah girl, and it's so much fun. And if you're, I share that grandchild with Ira Bodenheim. In any case, so Uncle Moshe says, you know, if you're happy and you know it, stamp your feet and clap your hands. And, oh, stamping his feet and clapping his hands, because it's so much fun. You know, that lasts till about 3. Then you get to be 4. And you say, Mommy, I want an ice cream cone. And Mommy says, but you just ate a fleishik meal. You're only 4, maybe you only have to wait an hour, or he's a yeki, maybe you only have to wait 3 hours, whatever, right? And the kid says, what are you talking about? This is not fun. I thought Torah is fun. This is not fun. I'm not waiting no hour for my ice cream cone. What kind of fun is this? And I'll tell you a secret. As you get older, there are a lot of things in Torah that are a lot less fun than waiting for an hour for an ice cream cone. A lot less fun. Believe me, ladies, it's great fun preparing for Pesach. Probably just scared them realizing that Purim is around the corner and then comes Pesach. That's fun? So, Torah is not fun. If we train our children that Torah is fun, they're going to find out very quickly that it's not. And then they're not going to want it. When there's a Shiloh white kids are going off the derech, because we taught them it's fun. It's not fun. On the other hand, Rav Moshe Feinstein says that a whole generation in America was lost to Shabbos because of parents who sacrificed for Shabbos. How could that be? Parents came the early 1900s to America expecting to find gold in the street. They couldn't find a job. They couldn't put food on the table. And then when they finally found a job, they found out that if they didn't show up on Shabbos, they didn't have a job on Monday. So many people succumbed to the pressure and they began to work on Shabbos. They went to daven. They had early minyanim. They daven from people. And big talesim. And then they went to work. And there were individuals who were moser nefesh, who didn't give in. And every week they had to look for another job. And they couldn't put food on their table. And their children gave up Shabbos, says Rav Moshe. How could it be? How could parents who sacrificed for Shabbos that their children should give up Shabbos? He said, you know why? Because these parents used to come home Friday night and krechts and moan and groan. Oh, Shabbos is so hard. And Shabbos is so difficult. It's so hard to be a Jew. And every week we have to look for a new job. And there's no food on the table. And they blamed it on Shabbos. So the kids aren't stupid. They hear the parents talking about this monster called Shabbos. Parents are crazy. Why in the world do they keep doing this monster? But we're going to get older. We're smarter. We're going to give it up. So what did Moshe mean? What should the parents have done? Come home and say, oh, this is so much fun. We can't think of anything more fun and exhilarating than looking for a job every week. Well, that's really fun. It's so exhilarating not to have food on the table. Right? That's a lot of fun. It's just fun, you know. It's not so much fun to eat. It's great fun to fast all the time. Look, that's what they should have said. What should they have said? It's true. It was difficult. You know what they should have said? They should have come at home and they should have said, yes, yeah, Shabbos is difficult. And it's not easy to look for a job every week. But you know what? It's kedai. It's worth it. Because the reward for keeping Shabbos is so eternally beneficial that it's worth it. It's worth all the sacrifices. That's what they should have said. That's what a child has to hear. Torah is worth it. It may not be fun, and it may not be easy, and it may not be fast, but it's worth it. That's the education you have to give children. I think that a program like you have, children understand it is not fun necessarily or easy to bicycle in the rain for 8 hours. It still got me, I'm going to think about it all night. Climbing a mountain is not necessarily fun. But if you put in the effort, you'll get a benefit from it. Torah is not fun. It's not less taxing than bicycling or climbing a mountain. But it's worth it. You'll feel good about yourself. You accomplished something that took effort, but the effort was worth it. You come out a lot healthier from it. So if you can understand that in that part of the week, you can understand that in the learning a piece of Gemara. It's not easy. You have to break your head over it. It's not computer games. It's not fun. But it's worth it. Mitzvahs are not fun, but they're worth it. And it could be the program you have brings that point out very nicely. Very nicely. Let me just end with one last medrash, and then we'll explain what the essence of Purim is. The Ora, the Simcha, the Sason, the Ikar. The medrash says that the Akiva was giving a drasha, and his Talmidim were falling asleep. Nothing has changed in 2,000 years. And he wanted to wake them up. So he said the following. Marosa Esther, Shemolcha, May of the Esther of Sheva Medinos. What did Esther see that enabled her to rule over 127 Medinos? Tovo Esther, Basbita Shosara, Shechoisa, May of the Esther of Sheva Shani. Let Esther, the great-great-granddaughter of Sarah, who lived 127 years, rule over 127 Medinos. So they all woke up. What's the connection between Sarah's 127 years and Esther's 127 Medinos, except the number? And Rabbi Akiva went on. I think Rabbi Akiva wanted to tell them the following. Sarah Imenu did not just live 127 years, that 127 years passed over her. But the Torah says, Shnei Chaye Sarah Kulam Shavim Latova. All of Sarah Imenu's years were equally for the good. Now that can't be understood literally, that all of Sarah Imenu's years were equally good. They weren't. The 90 years she didn't have Yitzchak weren't equally good with the 37 years she did. The night she was dragged to Paro or dragged to Avimelech was not equally good with the day they celebrated Yitzchak's bris. But it doesn't say that they were equally good. It says, Kulam Shavim Litova. They all were equally for the good. What does that mean? First of all, let's understand what good is. Tov. What's Tov? Good. One example only. Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. God said, let there be fish. And then Vayar Elokim Ki Tov. God saw that it was good. So in first grade, you're allowed to understand that the following infantile way. God said, let there be fish. And he willed fish into being, and then he took a look at him and he said, hey, not bad, looks like fish. I did a pretty good job. Pat himself on the back. I never thought it would come out this good. Well, it was pretty good. That's absurd. The Rebbe knew exactly what he was creating. He knew exactly how it would come out. I had to look at it and say, hey, looks good to me. What does it mean? Says the Ramban. What it means is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu wills things into creation with what we call speech. Hu Omar Vayehi. Vayomer Elokim. That brings the thing into existence. But what gives it the ability to continue to exist? That's Vayar Elokim. He looks at it, and that gives it the ability to continue to exist. Vayar Elokim, when the Rebbe Shalom looks at it, then it's Kitov, then it's viable. Then it has the ability to continue to exist. Hodu Lashem Kitov, Vay Kiliolam Chazro. The more something can exist, the more eternal it is, the more Tov it is. And therefore, Ein Tov El Torah, real eternity is Torah. Olam Habaz Yom Shekulo Tov. Yom Tov means a day that's beyond the physical of parameters of time and limitation of time. It transcends time. It's a day of eternity. That's Tov. Kulam shovim letova, Sara imenu, could not control the situations that came to her in life. She had good days and she had bad days. She had good situations and very negative situations. She couldn't control the situations. That HaKadosh Baruch Hu controlled. But kulam shovim litova, she saw them all as opportunities. The good and the bad, all of them were opportunities to create eternity. The Rabbanu Shalom sent it to her that she should be able to use it, what the purpose of this world is. Turn it into something positive. Use it to create eternity. That's what I'm sending you. Sometimes I'm sending you things that are fun and sometimes things that are very not fun. But use them. Everyone, kulam, shovim, lit over. They all were able to be used for eternity. Esther also lived a very, very miserable life, you think about it. She was plucked away from her husband Mordechai or her uncle Mordechai, whatever he was, according to Chazal, different conflicting Midrashim, as a young girl. And she was locked up in a palace, in a harem, with this animal of a goy, Achashverosh. I guarantee you, when she was in the Beis Yaakov of Shushan, this was not her dream. You know, oh, someday maybe I'll be the wife of Achashverosh. Right? She was dreaming of having a nice family, right? Being a nice Yiddish Nagel, having a nice chosen. And she was plucked from that and forced to live in that situation. And did she have children? Yeah, she had children. She had a son named Koresh, who thought he was a goy. Thought he was the king of Persia. He was the king of Persia. But he really was a little Jewish boy, but he didn't realize it. He was a nice guy too. Right? The Rebbe Hashem called him Mishichat. A nice man, but I can tell you for sure that Esther Hamalka did not walk around with a little picture of Koresh and say, here's my nachas, my son Koresh, who thinks he's a goy. Right, that was her nachas. She had a pretty difficult, miserable life. How did she take it and turn it into such a positive thing that she saved Klal Yisrael? And she's Esther Hamalka, and we celebrate her every year. Because she always looked to Sarah. Sarah didn't have an easy life either. Her life wasn't fun. It wasn't a bowl of cherries. But she always directed everything Latova for eternity. And Esther learned from her. And that's how she was able also. And that's what Rabbi Akiva told his Talmidim. It's not easy to stay up for a shiur. Believe me, when I'm on the other side of this microphone, my eyes are like I never slept for the last 40 years. And as soon as the person starts to speak, that's it, I'm finished. So I'm surprised you're all still up. Because it's not easy. Not easy. It's difficult. Life is difficult. Especially Rabbi Akiva's time. It was after the Churban. It was a really difficult time. But if Esther could do it, and Sarah could do it, you could do it too. And you have a lot less to do to stay up for a shear than Esther had or Sarah had. That's what life is all about. It may not be easy. And it may not be fun, and it may not be easy, and it may not be fast, but it's worth it. That's the message. That's what chinuch is all about, and that's what it says. You want to know what simcha is? La Yehudim Hoysa. It has four components. First, you have to have Torah. You have to understand what the philosophy of life is, because if you don't understand what the philosophy of life is, you're going to be running after Speedy the Rabbit all the time, and trying to put things into your stretch limousine that there's no end to. So you have to need Torah, you need a Torah orientation. That's the first thing. And then Simcha is Yontif. With that orientation, you have to know what eternity is. That this world is a prozor b'fnei ha'olam haba. It's a preparation room. That's all it is. That's all it was created to do. To give you the opportunity towards eternity. And every second can be converted into eternal pleasure. And you can enjoy this world too, knowing that you're creating that. That's Yom Tov. That's Simcha. And Sason is Mila. That the physical things in this world, your physical body, can attach you to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Everything you do, every part of life, economic, social, recreational, everything, can be done in a way that attaches you to the Ribbono Shel Olam. Bris Mila is in a person's body, not in his soul. It's the body, it's the physical things of this world that can attach you to the Ribbono Shel Olam if you use them properly. And your car is tefillin. Tefillin is that the Ribbono Shel Olam is mashgiach, there's divine providence. God is the one who sends you the situations in life that come your way. And they may not always be fun, and they may always be easy. And sometimes they're downright tragic. But they're all opportunities. If you use them properly, you can create eternity from them. If you have the right outlook on life, then you'll always be happy. And if you have the wrong outlook on life, you'll never be happy. Simcha is not things. Simcha is an attitude. And if you have that attitude, your kohen, it's not easy. It's not easy and it's not fast to acquire that attitude. It takes time, it takes a lot of learning, it takes a lot of mussar, it takes a lot of life experience. But if you understand that that's the goal, then in Yirtzeh Hashem we can learn from Purim. Things look pretty dismal, but the Rebbeinu Shlomo's always there. And he always hears our tefillahs. And he's sending us those things that will give us eternal pleasure, eternal good. That's what Purim is all about. That we're important, that life is important, and that the Rebbeinu Shlomo is always there for us. If we understand that, then we'll talk ahead. By Yehudim Hoysa Ora, the Simcha, the Sosum, the Kar, and Kein Tielanu, La Orech Yom Yitzchak.